A third round of voting takes place this Saturday, June 20th through Tuesday, June 23rd for president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. If you're a registered voter for the 2026 LCMS presidential election, I strongly encourage you to vote to reelect Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Matt Harrison, for a final three-year term. If you're not a voter, please encourage your pastor and your congregation's lay voter to vote for President Harrison. Remember to vote June 20th through the 23rd. Well, that time of the triennium is approaching, the 69th Regular Convention of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. This is an opportunity for the congregations to have some representation at the convention through pastoral and lay delegates. They decide some things that are simply, well, mom and baseball and apple pie. And then they decide some things that really do make a difference in the life of the church as we live it out together. What are those things in the 69th Regular Convention that are coming up that need our consideration, and how does the whole thing work? Welcome back to Issues Etc. Joining us to talk about the 69th Regular Convention of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Mark Stern. He's an attorney in Chicago, former chairman of the Board of Regents at Concordia University Chicago, currently a member of the Board of Regents at Concordia Seminary St. Louis, and he previously served on floor committees for theology and church relations and university education. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you, Pastor Wilkin, and want to say again what a great Issues Etc. conference you had last weekend. Still thinking about that and the speakers.
Thank you very much. I think this morning we got the results of the second round or the second ballot in the election of president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. What were the results so far?
President Harrison remains in the lead. He has 46.3% of the vote. However, a majority is required, so this is going to go to a third ballot. Dr. Bierman got 46.0% of the vote, so it's gotten very, very close. There were a number of new voters that did not vote in the first round, and Vice President Lang dropped off, so there was one fewer candidate.
So what happens next?
This will go to a third round of voting starting, I think, Saturday, although you'll want to double-check me on that. The same electors are eligible to vote. You use the same criteria and credentials, and you would log on and vote electronically. Certainly, I would encourage everybody, as you have done, to get out and vote. President Harrison, you know, this is one of those things. Luther said he wants a perfect church, wants no church at all. He wants a perfect synod president, wants no synod president at all. And the appropriate standard is not what President Harrison has done versus what Jesus Christ would have done, but looking at the many things that he outlined at his Issues Etc. presentation over the last several terms he served, and recognizing that things can be worse as well as better. So I would encourage the listeners to reelect President Harrison.
So I think this bears repeating. We are really in terms of the process of the presidential elections, voting online. This is somewhat unprecedented. Tell us about that.
Yes. So up until 2010, the presidents were elected at the Synod Convention. In 2010, as part of the Blue Ribbon restructuring, the elections were moved so that instead of the convention delegates voting, there would be one pastor and one lay delegate elector from each congregation or parish, and those people would vote to elect the Synod president prior to the convention. So that made the electorate much larger and more diffuse. We saw an initial surge of participation, but the participation percentages have been going down over time. President Harrison was reelected each time on the first ballot. So this is the first time since prior to 2010 that there has been a second ballot for Senate president. I think 2001 was the last time.
How likely is it to require ballots past the third?
I don't know. I think at this point it's evident that one of two candidates will be elected, and I think each voter should sit down and consider what direction they would like the synod to go, whether there is going to be a continued faithful proclamation or whether there's going to be openings for practices and activities that I think many of your listeners would not necessarily agree with, regardless of the personal faithfulness of the individual candidate. And I'm not casting aspersions on any of the five men that were up there. But it often becomes an issue of what is going to be allowed and permitted in the synod? Are we going to actually walk together? Are we going to keep working towards that faithfulness? Or are we going to allow a divergence of practice that may draw us farther apart?
Folks, the third round of voting for president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod takes place this Saturday, June 20th through Tuesday, June 23rd. If you're a registered voter, I strongly encourage you to vote to re-elect President Matt Harrison for a final three-year term. If you're not a voter, please encourage your pastor and your congregation's lay voter to vote for Pastor Harrison. Remember to vote this Saturday, June 20th through Tuesday, June 23rd. So let's talk about some of the resolutions that will come before the convention when it gathers in Phoenix, the 69th Regular Convention of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. We can't talk about all of them, obviously, but give us a little context on how it goes from a resolution that gets submitted and printed in the workbook that's been out for a couple weeks or perhaps a month to the convention floor for a vote.
Sure. Those of us in Generation X may remember the schoolhouse rock about how a bill becomes law. That is not entirely how the synod process works. The synod process starts at the grassroots, and overtures, which are recommendations for action, come in from congregations, from circuits, from districts, from agencies of synod, a couple other sources. So those overtures are suggestions. They can encourage, they can criticize, they can change synod bylaws, they can ask for study of an issue, approve fellowship or remove fellowship with another church body, or a variety of other things. So there were 374 of those submitted, printed in the workbook, like you said, which all this and other documents can be viewed and downloaded on the Synod website. So those 374 got grouped by topic into 10 different floor committees. Floor committee is a group of delegates, both advisory delegates and voting delegates, usually chaired by a district president that reviews and vets overtures and decides what to recommend to the convention for action. The floor committees are very important. They play a critical role in deciding what actually comes to the convention floor for discussion. So they meet prior to the convention, they look at the overtures, they put them into numbered resolutions, and that's where we are at this point. And you will notice, if you look at the today's business, which is sort of the second installment of the workbook, that many of the overtures are grouped into a resolution. Some of those are for and some of those are against what the floor committee actually decides it is going to recommend. So for example, seminaries was a very hot topic this time. Almost 25% of the overtures came in relating to seminary education topics, be they the so-called rogue seminaries that are out there, these online seminaries that are being created by some affiliated with the Missouri Synod but not authorized by the Missouri Synod. There are overtures regarding the specific ministry pastor program, or SMP, which is an accelerated route to ministry or alternate route that was created about 20 years ago to be used for exceptional circumstances but has become more prevalent in the last few years. There are some people that want to make that broader. There are some people that want to make that narrower. So you will see that the floor committee, I think, has mostly done a pretty good job in coalescing those overtures into resolutions that for the most part are saying, we have a process that's been successful, that is our residential seminaries, informing pastors that are faithful, that are well-trained, well-grounded, that know Scripture, that know the biblical languages and are able to serve our congregations. And we would like to continue to strengthen that process and not experiment with sort of online ad hoc or silo formation programs, which tend to create pastors that are lone rangers and not walking together with one another and with the Synod.
So the floor committees have several avenues available to them when they kind of omnibus resolutions, and they have different purposes vis-a-vis the resolutions they contain. Walk us through some of that.
Sure. So in addition to rolling the overtures into resolutions, the floor committees can do four other things with an overture. There are called omnibuses, which means a large batch of overtures that are dealt with in a single blow, as it were. So there's what's called Omnibus A, and I remember these letters by what they sort of stand for. This is just my crib sheet. A means anyone else. So this means a committee thinks a different entity within Synod, other than the convention, should handle the matter. So if there's an overture about a specific issue with Concordia Plan Services, they might send it Omnibus A to the Concordia Plan Services Board. Omnibus B means before. We've already talked about it. We've already discussed it. We really don't need to spend time on it again. So it seems like every convention, there's an overture to go from a three-year to a four-year convention cycle. This has been discussed, voted on a number of times. Everybody said pretty much, we're going to stick with a three-year cycle. Committee says, Omnibus B, we're not going to bring this forward and rehash it one more time. Omnibus C means commend. These are often overtures saying we give thanks for the 75th anniversary of this organization or that organization, and it's a worthy cause, but it's not something that necessarily needs to take up convention time and debate because nobody's really debating it. So they will commend, for example, the 120th anniversary of the Atlantic District, but we don't really need to take up convention time with that. And lastly, the floor committees can decline an overture, meaning simply they're not going to deal with it for one reason or another. They don't think it's appropriate. They don't think it's good reasoning or something like that. And those just go away.
The things that make it through the process are printed in what you had mentioned before, Today's Business. This is a document that is kind of the lifeblood of a synodical convention.
Yes. Today's Business comes out. The first edition is out now. As I said, you can look it up on the website. And then a new one is printed every day. This has the resolutions in it. And this is an opportunity for all of your audience to actually take part in this process, whether you are commissioned, whether you're ordained, whether you're a layman. If you're a part of the Missouri Synod Congregation, you can weigh in by writing to the floor committees by email, and there are instructions on how to do that, and giving your thoughts. So you may say, I don't like this resolution. I think it should be defeated or changed. I think it could be improved. Or you may just want to say, I think this is a great resolution, because the committees, and I was on different committees for three conventions, they do read and take into account what is submitted to them because they're looking to do the best service to the church that they can do. And sometimes it's helpful for them to hear, this is a great resolution, I like this, I hope you'll keep it the way it is, because the comments often tend to be negative, and sometimes it's helpful for the committee just to get some encouragement.
The floor committees also hold kind of open forums or open hearings as well?
Yes. There will be open hearings. Those are held on the Saturday before the convention starts in the morning. So if you happen to be in Phoenix, you don't have to be a delegate. You can just go. You can stand up. You'll get a couple minutes to say to the committee whatever it is you think should occur, and they will listen to you. I would encourage people to submit things in writing in advance simply because it gives the committee more time, because as soon as those open hearings are over, the committees meet that afternoon and they've got to hash everything out and get it ready by, I think it's 5-6 o'clock in the evening. So it's a very, very intense job for those that are serving on floor committees. So the earlier they can hear things is always the better.
What happens when these resolutions, either individual resolutions or the omnibuses, what happens when it's time for them on the floor of the convention itself?
So the first thing that happens is the omnibuses will be called up and they are voted on. There is an opportunity for delegates to ask to remove an individual item from the omnibus. So if one thinks that something is being omnibused, well, I really think we should have a resolution, they can make a motion on the floor to remove it. The convention votes up or down, should it be removed, should it not be removed. If it's removed, it gets sent back to the committee, and the committee has to bring a resolution forward to discuss it. If it's not approved, it stays in the omnibus. The omnibuses will pass, you know, 90-95%, and then that will be the end of it, and that topic will not be considered further at the convention.
Mark Stern is our guest. We're talking about the 69th Regular Convention of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We'll get into some particular resolutions that he thinks are noteworthy and find out if there's anything missing from the resolutions that should be there. A third round of voting takes place this Saturday, June 20th through Tuesday, June 23rd for President of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. If you're a registered voter for the 2026 LCMS presidential election, I strongly encourage you to vote to re-elect Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Matt Harrison, for a final three-year term. If you're not a voter, please encourage your pastor and your congregation's lay voter to vote for President Harrison. Remember to vote June 20th through the 23rd.
For nearly 140 years, the Lutheran Witness has taught the faith, defended it against error, and shown forth the great treasures of the Lutheran Church and biblical doctrine. We're continuing this legacy by publishing issues and articles that help you see the world from a Lutheran perspective and that teach biblical doctrine and show forth the treasures of God's Word. Visit our website to learn more and how to subscribe, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Does this sound like your church budget process at the end of the year? You get last year's budget and go through with a committee line by line, maybe what we should spend next year. Maybe you have a prayer. But where's the Word of God in this process? When do the people hear what the small catechism says about giving and why we do it? Contact us at LCMS Stewardship so that we can help you fix this process, put the Word of God first, and put your congregation on a good footing. lcms.org/stewardship.
Luther Academy provides additional theological education for our mission partners around the world, specifically pastors who are asking for additional education but do not have the necessary resources in their own church bodies. By donating to Luther Academy today, you will be supplying food, housing, books, professors, and travel for Lutheran pastors who attend our conferences. To learn more about Luther Academy and how you can donate today, visit lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
At the center of our campus is Kramer Chapel, and there's a reason for that.
Issues, Etc. guest, Dr. Arthur Just.
Because it is the heartbeat of Concordia Theological Seminary. It is where we go to hear the voice of Jesus and frequently be fed with the body and blood of Christ. We sometimes call it our Jerusalem. Kramer Chapel points to the classroom, which we sometimes call Athens. It is there that we do theology, biblical studies, systematic theology, practical theology, history. We love theology here, and we love the study of it, and we love coming together in worship. It's one of the things that gives us great joy. Joy in worshiping, joy in studying theology. Concordia Theological Seminary is all about the joy of being in Jesus.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, ctsfw.edu.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. We're talking about the 69th Regular Convention of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Mark Stern is our guest, an attorney in Chicago, former chairman of the Board of Regents at Concordia University Chicago. He's currently a member of the Board of Regents at Concordia Seminary St. Louis. He previously served on the floor committees for theology and church relations and university education. The Lutheran Witness magazine interprets the world from a Lutheran perspective and belongs in the hands of every Lutheran layman and pastor. You can receive an annual digital and print subscription for less than $25. Learn more at witness.lcms.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, the Lutheran Witness magazine. Mark, before we get into the particular resolutions you wanted to highlight, is there anything missing from these resolutions that you believe should have been included?
One area I think is missing is so-called assisted suicide. Sadly, you're in Illinois, I'm in Illinois. The Illinois General Assembly has passed an assisted suicide law. There is a court challenge pending. I don't know where that will end up, but this has happened. We've seen it in Canada. We've seen it in Europe. There is a great CTCR report on this in the convention workbook, but for some reason there were no overtures on it and the committee did not pick it up. So I would definitely encourage the floor committee, and I'd encourage people to write to maybe Committee 3, Mercy, and suggest that they bring a resolution in opposition to this wicked practice. There are a number of other resolutions. I think generally committees have done a pretty good job. On seminaries, as I said, the floor committee has stuck with our residential seminaries, which are, you know, beloved in the synod. One area I was a little surprised, Resolution 610 dealing with adjunct faculty and saying that those faculty members would not be entitled to a call to their position. I don't really understand that argument. I think Article 14 of the Augsburg Confession is pretty clear. If you're publicly teaching, you should receive a call, a rightly ordered call. So I think that one probably should be withdrawn or defeated. I think there are other areas that could possibly be improved. President Harrison has called for a task force to address dispute resolution bylaws. This is an area that has been problematic in the Synod for the last couple cycles. There needs to be more clarity. There needs to be a better process to deal with disputes so that we don't get into these internet flame wars that you've been seeing when there's a perception that nothing is happening, and in fact, something may be happening, but it can't be talked about because there are restrictions on what can be said. The task force is proposed to be district presidents, district secretaries, and I think it would be helpful if they added some parish pastors or some people with legal training to help draft those, because it's not just the people that administer it, it's the people that have to live under the system that I think should be participating. And another resolution that I think is going to be very interesting is 9-11, which is to amend bylaw section 1.5, et cetera, to unify in the bylaws and revise corporate formation requirements for instrumental entities of corporate synod and agencies of the synod. And if that sounded long, it is. I don't know if it's the longest title, but it's the longest resolution of the convention. It's 13 and a half pages of small print. And what it does is allow synod agencies to create a new category of entities to hold property. It is argued that this will allow us to make better use of underutilized property, but I think there's a lot of risk in this because we've seen issues, but with Concordia, Texas, with other entities where there has not been bylaw compliance, and I am not sure we have the bandwidth to accommodate this. I think the committee may want to consider narrowing that so that the board of directors could perhaps make an exception if there's an urgent need, but I am not sure we need 13 pages of bylaws to create a whole universe of different legal entities. I think that is getting us away from the core business of the church, which is proclamation of the gospel and getting us into these property matters that are really not our core competency. But I know there's a lot of different opinions on that topic.
There have been some overtures regarding what's called prior approval, a process. Tell us what that process is and what's being proposed.
Yes, I should have mentioned that as well. Prior approval is a process that's used for college and university presidents and for theology faculties, both at the seminary level and the college and university level. And what this says is that before a man can be called either as a university president or as a faculty member in the theology area, there is a prior approval. Now, that's not one person. It is wrongly accused that President Harrison is somehow personally vetoing people. It is a three-person panel consisting of the president, consisting of a district president, either the chairman of the COP or another district president, and a member of a board such as the CUS board or the Board of National Mission. And they look at the individual that's being proposed, and it is somewhat of a black box. And this is what's frustrating people. They're saying, well, I want a list of 10 things, and if this person meets those 10 requirements, this person should be approved, because if they're not approved, they can't be called. And the problem with that is there's Eighth Commandment and other issues out there, and I'll give you an example. When I was on the board at Concordia Chicago, and I'm not going to give too many specifics, we had an individual who was up for consideration for a position, a very solid man, orthodox, wonderful family man, wonderful pastor, completely lacking in the qualifications that were needed for the position that he was nominated for. So it would not have done a service to approve him to be considered, because that person wouldn't have done well, the institution wouldn't have done well. But it would also not be helpful to blast out to the church and we say, you know, Dr. Schmidt, and that's not his name, Dr. Schmidt is just totally unqualified for this job, and that's why he rejected him. I mean, that's a terrible thing to say to somebody. So it's the same reason if you're calling a pastor, you may have a short list on your call list, and the congregation votes to call one man and not the others. You don't send a letter to the others saying, this is why we didn't call you. We accept that it's God's will to provide us with a qualified man for this particular position. So the resolutions, the overtures were calling for basically they wanted a checklist. And the committee did not do that. The committee said, and this is Committee 7, we are going to ask for additional explanations in the Lutheran Witness to explain what this process is and how it works. And we're going to try to create a protocol for it. But it will not go and do what all the overtures or some of the overtures wanted, which is basically to make everything wide open, which I think would lead to very unfortunate results, both for some of the candidates and for the institutions.
And we should point out there is, in addition to qualification issues, there's also questions of church discipline that by the very nature of them that information needs to be protected. This is a check and balance that would allow, if there's a district president that needs to be contacted, say, is this person in good standing? Are there problems here? That should be a private inquiry, and that should be definitely considered before approval.
Yes. Again, you have to protect the reputation of individuals because, you know, and this is, I am generally a proponent of transparency. I like things to be disclosed where they can be disclosed. But when you're dealing with personnel matters, and if anybody who works in a private enterprise situation has these same things, you're not going to get a letter saying normally this person did this and this person did that. You're going to try and deal with it privately, their liability concerns, their reputational concerns. And ultimately, there has to be some level of trust in the fact that there's a three-person committee that's doing this vetting and the majority will speak. It's not one individual cannot control whether a person is or is not admitted. It's part of the multi-level process. You have search committees, you have boards, you have the prior approval panel. They all get together before a call is issued, which again is I think important for all faculty, full-time, part-time, that there be a robust process and that when they're called, they are recognized as such.
You had mentioned a few minutes ago our dispute resolution process. And again, it is a bit of a black box too in some of its facets, but what is being proposed for changes there? Because many believe the process is more or less broken, although much of it happens behind closed doors, so we don't know. What are your thoughts?
I don't know that the process is broken. I think the process is doing what it was designed to do, which is to try to reconcile people. The problem with that is there's some things that cannot be reconciled. So if one is disputing, for example, I'm mad at this person because I thought the carpet in the church should have been red, the carpet was blue, my grandmother gave money for the red carpet, etc. There's always sin on both sides, but there's probably a situation where perhaps people can be brought together. But if there are serious doctrinal issues going on, that's not a process for reconciliation. There may be need for reconciliation apart from that, but there also has to be repentance and there has to be an addressing of the errors publicly because the Bible not only teaches us, go to your brother, but it says that against an elder, do not receive accusations but by two or three witnesses, but you have to rebuke that person publicly. And that's where I think things break down. I've talked to a district president friend of mine who had very bad situation with a couple pastors in his district, and he said it took him, in one case, 3 years to deal with a pastor that ultimately got removed from the roster. And that really shouldn't be the case. You know, it's sort of you hear secularly justice delayed is justice denied, but we are dealing with the oversight of souls, the shepherding of parishioners, and I would like to see a process that is more adjudicatory, that actually reaches a determination, and that moves relatively quickly with due process, with an opportunity for everybody to be heard, but not one that drags on and simply generates paper for the sense of generating paper. And I think also at the end of the day, it's helpful to have an announcement if it can be done without harming anybody. If there's a victim involved with something, then obviously no, you don't want to make any information available that would publicize that victim's status. But if an individual is removed for a doctrinal issue, I think that the church is entitled to know, yes, there's a doctrinal issue here. This was the resolution of it. This is why that person was removed. You will need a task force. It's a very, very complicated issue, but the process should be shorter, it should be cleaner, and it should be more adjudicatory.
Mark Stern is an attorney in Chicago. He's a former chairman of the Board of Regents at Concordia University, Chicago. He's currently a member of the Board of Regents at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. Previously served on the floor committees for theology and church relations and university education. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you, Pastor Wilkin.
Thursday on Issues Etc., we'll talk to Dr. Andrew Steinman about conspiracy theories in the Book of Enoch, and we'll discuss religious classification of Mormons by the U.S. Pentagon with Bill McKeever. It's also Kids Have Questions with Pastor Jonathan Connor. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.